Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, welcome to Starting Overdrive, where you'll hear real stories of starting over from real people of all walks of life. I'm your host, Reg Seaton. There are times when life seems like a river. We follow the flow along various twists, turns, obstacles, and challenges within what we believe is our own organic path in life. Sometimes we choose those twists and turns in the river of life. Other times, we're forced into facing obstacles and challenges we never expected. It often takes forced change and unforeseen events to reveal the direction we were meant to follow in our own unique river of life. In this episode of Starting Overdrive, I talk with Andrew Girard, former world-renowned hypnotist, mentalist, and magician, who worked with Chris Angel and David Blaine, headlined his own show in Las Vegas, before he was forced to start over from a car accident at the height of his career. As you'll discover, Andrew found himself lost in a period of recovery, memory loss, and the effects of a traumatic brain injury that forced him to leave the world of mentalism and magic. However, prior to his accident, Andrew's life was rooted in reinvention and renaissance, which helped him find a new award-winning career in photography, cinematography, writing, and directing. Although Andrew's river took him into the world of magic, his accident was a gateway into a new, unexpected career. Find out how Andrew Girard started over from it all on the latest episode of Starting Overdrive. Andrew Girard, welcome to Starting Overdrive.
Nice. Thank you so much for having me.
You've had an amazingly diverse career. It's really quite unique and inspiring. Today, you're an award-winning photographer, cinematographer, director, and musician, which I want to explore. However, before we get to your story of starting over, I just want to talk a bit about your life before your accident. Let me start with the world of magic and mentalism. You were known as the world-renowned Girard the Hypnotist. Is that correct?
I was, yeah. And occasionally, I still am on the street. I made a conscious decision when I decided to do hypnosis on stage and professionally and in TV, that I wouldn't use my full name, but just my middle name, which is Girard, as my only name. So I could have some kind of separation of my actual home and family life and then show business. So today, when people call me Girard, I know that they know me from either TV or seeing me perform. But if they say Andrew, I know it's not from that. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. I was going to ask you, who is Andrew Girard Henderson?
Yeah, well, you got my whole name. Usually people think it's Andrew Girard. And it's kind of an interesting story. My given name at birth actually was Andrew André Girard Poulain, which is a French name. And Poulain or Poulin was my biological father's name. And my grandfather on my mother's side had four daughters and four sisters. So no men carry on the Henderson name. So I believe it was somewhere around his 80th birthday. Me and my brother both changed our last name from our father's name, who hasn't been in our life since we were 12 years old, to my grandfather's name to kind of honor him and carry on the Henderson name. So that's kind of an interesting thing in of itself. Growing up, people called me Andy. Early in my life, I was a hairstylist. And the first salon I ever worked in, there was another guy that looked almost exactly like me. His name is Anthony. So people would come into the salon and say, I want the blonde guy to cut my hair, the 6-foot-tall blonde guy. And there was two of us. And they go, was it Andrew or Anthony? And they go, ooh, can't remember. So the owner decided, he goes, what's your middle name? And I said, Girard. He goes, okay, from this day forward, you will be known as Andrew Girard and you will be known as Anthony. So that's where I started using my middle name and first name together. And it stuck ever since then. I don't know if that answers the question of who I am, but at least we got my name covered.
You've also been a producer and writer and consultant on several TV shows. And
yeah,
you've headlined the Riviera in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And your work has appeared on Oprah and Ellen and Letterman. And you were also a consulting producer and cast member on Chris Angel Mind Freak, plus a consulting producer for David Blaine as well.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that became your primary career path?
Yeah. Life is like a river that twists and turns and it winds us and takes us down these different avenues. And sometimes we fight against the stream and things get hard. And then sometimes you kind of relax and just go with the flow. And I found that my journey to working not only with Chris Angel and Mind Freak, but even getting there, I released control, I guess you could say, to the universe or God or fill in the blank, whatever thing people believe in. It really started by chance. I just had a friend of mine in town, and he said, hey, there's a hypnotist here from Las Vegas visiting, and I think you guys should meet. And I said, I don't have time. He said, well, be a quick coffee. And then I'm like, I don't know, maybe tomorrow. He goes, oh, he goes back tomorrow. And somehow they ended up just buzzing my apartment and just said, oh, we'll just stop in and say hi. And I met this guy. His name is Scott Lewis, Dr. Scott Lewis. He was actually the resident hypnotist at the Riviera. And my friend and me and him, we kind of met and we got along really quite well. So it wasn't until almost a year later that he said, do you want to come down and take over my show and headline at the Riviera? And I thought, geez, should I do this? And at the same time, a very good friend of mine, Bro Gilbert, who's also a magician and who worked on Mind Freak with me as a consultant, I brought him in later. He convinced me simultaneously to go to Victoria, to Vancouver Island, where I grew up, because there is a mentalist there named Banachek, and he was doing a lecture. I'm sure that Banachek had heard of me, and I had obviously heard of him. And so me and Bro went, and we just caught the last ferry to Victoria, and we just got there in time. And we walked into the lecture, and me and Banachek both looked at each other. He knew who I was. I knew who he is. So without a word spoken, we kind of arranged to kind of pull a fast one over on all the other magicians that were at the lecture. And we made kind of a semi-miracle happen, and nobody knew that we knew each other because we actually didn't, but that's how we met. And then out in the parking lot after we talked, he goes, that was great. Thanks for that. And I'm like, yeah, that was cool, man. And he had mentioned he'd seen some of my stuff. And I said, of course, he's really famous. And he goes, you know, I'm working with this guy, Chris Angel. And it was like season one of Mind Freak. He said, if you're ever in Vegas, you know, and come down and yada, yada, yada. So anyway, one thing led to another. I told my boss at the time, I was working at a hair salon. I said, I want to go to Las Vegas and perform. And he said, you can't. You've got like, I had clients that I was working and I couldn't just leave. He said, basically said, if you leave, you're fired. And so I said, okay, well, I don't want to get fired. So I quit. And I just did it on my own terms. And I went down, performed at the Riviera, loved it. Doing my show down in Vegas was amazing. It was a dream come true for anybody that's a performer to play Vegas. And then while I was down there, I ended up meeting up with Banachek and Chris and performing for them.
How did you leverage that being an unknown?
I think in my act, all the tricks that I were doing were original to me. In other words, I devised the method of how these things work myself. And it fooled a lot of other magicians and mentalists because a lot of performers kind of do the similar trick. So they know how each other's tricks work. I think that that kind of created a bit of a stir about my act. So when I met Chris Angel, he was very interested in what I was doing. And we got along like a house on fire. And fast forward, I get a phone call and come down 2 months later to a meeting where they're kind of auditioning maybe 10 or 12 other magicians and mentalists in a room. And everyone was kind of jockeying for position. And I wasn't about playing that game. So I just kind of sat there and was quiet. Then afterwards, I kind of just mentioned to Chris, I said, I saw you do this guest appearance on Las Vegas. I have a way that you can walk on water. And he goes, really? And I go, yeah. So we kind of talked. He goes, I love that. We went in and started working on this trick. And that was the beginning of our kind of friendship and working together. It was an amazing few years to come, going back and forth from Vancouver to Vegas. I guess the kind of moral of the story is I took a huge, I wouldn't say a leap of faith. It was pretty stupid to do the decision I made just to abandon my job and everything just to go play Vegas just to say that I did it. But I knew that if I didn't do it, I would become resentful and not be happy in my life if I didn't take control of that. So I decided to quit my job. I had no idea what I was coming back to. And for the record, I had nothing to fall back on. So in other words, I dropped out of school in grade 8, so I don't even have a high school education. Things worked out for me, and I don't recommend that to anybody listening. But if you are a creative person and you know, you have this feeling, you know what you're supposed to do and you're good at it, and other people have told you that, and you're being paid to do that, there's a chance that you should probably stick with your gut feeling and try. Otherwise, you'll never know. And that's the real sad thing in life is when at the end of our lives, I don't think that we look back and think about all the accomplishments we did. I think we sit there and probably think about maybe the regrets, things we didn't do or we wish we had done.
And I think that only gets more clear as we get older.
I'm 49 as I'm doing this interview with you, and I can honestly say that I have absolutely no regrets. I've ticked so many boxes in my life. I can't believe I made it this far. I feel like I snuck into a concert, and I've been waiting for someone to tap me on the shoulder and say, you're not supposed to be here.
This segues into my next question. It seems like you really had a strong connection to starting over or reinventing yourself even before your success as a mentalist. I know that you toured across the country in a band in your late teens.
Yeah.
You were a model. You mentioned that you were a hairstylist at one point. Looking back now at those early days, was the process of starting over or reinventing yourself more a creative expression of who you were at the time?
this is going to sound incredibly cheesy, but in my life, there's been a few things that people have said in passing that I ended up taking way too seriously. So I have these, before memes were a thing, they're just quotes and expressions in my head. And I remember I was maybe a young teenager, 12 years old or 13 years old. My parents got divorced and I thought, well, who the hell am I going to be? I don't know who I am. So I've been kind of starting over since before I was even a teenager. And I remember clearly somebody telling me a quote, and it was something to the effect of, the most powerful thing you can do is sacrifice who you are for who you can become. And I never forgot that. I've said that over and over. I don't know who said it. I should probably Google it now that we have the internet. I've just never bothered because it's been like almost my mantra. It's to sacrifice who you are for who you can become. And that's an incredibly valuable tool, because initially you feel like, well, if I quit something, I've dedicated this much time into doing things this way or living my life this way, and if I don't keep going with it, I'm quitting and I'm losing all that time. But what if you're not on the right path? Remember I mentioned that river flowing. What if you're on the wrong river flowing? You know, like, you're not the right thing. You've been wasting that time. So you should abandon that as soon as possible and get on to the right thing. And I think that that's true not only for your life path, but for relationships. People go, oh, I've been in a marriage for 10 years and I don't want to get divorced now because it'll, or leave now because it'll separate. And I understand that, that dedication. But at the same time, if that wasn't meant to be and you've been forcing destiny to go your way, then that's not a good thing. You know, you're better off to do the other thing. So you have the choice and it's in your control, but people don't even realize sometimes that there could be a better or different version of themselves out there waiting, because as beings, we're extremely complacent.
That's a huge challenge that can really work against us.
I don't think anybody wants to be happy in their life, like running around smiling and giggling happy. I think people just want to be at peace. And as long as people have a sense of peace and calm, there's no reason to rock the boat or to change anything or to start anything over, because they'll just keep doing what they're doing until it doesn't work anymore. So my kind of philosophy is, I haven't waited for things to collapse and have a catastrophic failure in my life. When I see an opportunity to look inside myself and say, is there a better part of you that you could express here, or more of you to grow, I give that opportunity a chance and I say yes. And I think that that was instilled in me at a very young age. So I said yes to a lot of opportunities early on. And I was always very optimistic and seeing the bright side and all that kind of stuff. But starting over in career-wise, I mean, I never thought I'd have a career. I mean, just a funny side note, I didn't have my driver's license until I was 35. I never had a car because I grew up, you know, struggling and everything. And so I just never bothered needing a car. When I started performing hypnosis, I got endorsed by Dream Limousine, a limo company. So they'd take me to all my shows where I could walk everywhere to the salon and where I worked. So I really didn't need a car. So I just didn't have one. And then after I got into TV and started finally making some money doing what I love, and thank God that I stuck with it, because that's really the key to success that people don't know, is people give up way too early. Mm-hmm. So anytime, even today, I get young people that I mentor asking me, do you think that I could really do this? If they have something, I will tell them, say, yes, do it. And if anybody likes it, that's a good sign, because if one person likes it, that means there's got to be more people out there that will like it. Maybe they'll pay for it and maybe you'll get some satisfaction in it. The roundabout way that I'm getting to, I think, trying to say, is that you've got to be on target. You have to shoot for the bullseye of where your passion really is. That's what I've always done. I've always found where my passion is and I've stuck with that. Otherwise, people are going to universities, getting degrees in things that they hate doing, and then dropping out and returning to their passion later in life. Or people are settling in relationships for people that they don't really love, and then they get divorced.
Well, how do you break the cycle?
I think you really have to meditate and look inside and find your center, your passion, and shoot for that, because that is where you're going to be successful. Not necessarily financially, like, I mean,
internally.
For me, definition of success is knowing that you're becoming the person you were meant to be.
How do you know who you were meant to be?
Well, that's a question that you've got to look inside yourself and find your true passion, to find your bullseye and aim for that and never compromise. That's been kind of my rule. And that's what's made me overcome all the trials and tribulations that I've gone through.
Well, that's what I wanted to get into next, is at the height of your career in magic, your life suddenly and abruptly changed when you were involved in an accident. Can you explain what happened?
Yeah. It was on Halloween, actually, in 2011, around 3 o'clock, and I was in my car, and I got rear-ended, and it was pretty traumatic. I ended up suffering a mild traumatic brain injury, and I had a whole list of complications, everything from vision and losing hearing and my back. And that was something that completely had ripped me out of my life. And nothing, we take a lot of things for granted in this life, Reg, but the one thing that we truly can't comprehend is how lucky we are just to be able to have our health. Not any special things, just being able to walk and breathe and taste and hear and see, because there's a lot of people that can't do that. And an accident or anything in life can come along and take these things away from you. And I'm amazed at how resilient we are as human beings and our brains and how much we can take and bounce back and still somehow soldier on. But for me, I'd placed at that point after the accident, it was a good couple of years, a year and a half of recovery, really, to get even close to some sense of like being able to cope with my new broken brain, where I wasn't very good at multitasking and my focus and attention. Magic and things became harder. All of a sudden, someone would pick a card and I'd have my magical way of finding out or reading their mind what it is. And then I'd forget. And so now I'm stuck really trying to read their mind because I can't remember. My memory was shot and I had all kinds of issues that just didn't allow me to do the things that I was able to do. So that didn't stop me, though, from doing it. It just made me find another way. It just made me find another little canal to carve out in my river of how I was going to navigate moving forward. So I just kept compensating and finding ways to do that. And I actually think about this all the time because every morning I go to a coffee shop here and there's a guy, he's got a dog with three legs. And the dog walks, it's one of its front legs is missing. And the dog walks and plays. And it's amazing how much people can, even animals, we can just kind of like have these horrible things happen to us and somehow find a way to not only move on, but to move on and be at peace and have joy.
What did it feel like to not have control over your brain or your mind after making a career from quote unquote mind control?
Yeah, well, it was something that I definitely tried to hide from the public. I never mentioned it because I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I'm supposed to be known as this guy with a super mind that can do all these things. And all of a sudden I can't even remember my own phone number, or I'm having panic attacks trying to pick out a spaghetti sauce in the aisle of the grocery store because I'm overwhelmed. So it's the most terrifying thing. And to be honest, I haven't talked about that a lot, but I have sang about it quite a bit. I've written a few songs as a musician, which I never sang before my accident. My accident banged something loose in my head because I'd never touched a camera before my accident. I'd never filmed a movie or any video. I'd never sang, but it must have knocked something loose in such a way that all of a sudden I discovered I could sing, and I taught myself photography and cinematography and writing, and creatively, I just like, I don't know what happened. Or maybe I'm just too stupid to know I should have quit a long time ago, and I just keep doing things. I just have this misplaced confidence in myself, but I just, for some reason, don't feel like there's anything that I can't do. But it was terrifying at the time, because to lose control of your mental faculties is like being trapped. One of my songs off my album is called Forest Fire, and it says, you know, I feel like I'm trapped inside a forest fire in my mind. And that's kind of what it feels like. In that time, all I remember wanting is somebody, anybody, to say, everything's going to be okay. You're going to get better than what it is now. Even all the 32 therapists I saw, nobody ever said, it's going to get better. They were always trying to rehash the story and trying to help me. But in some ways, you know, all I needed to hear was that there is, I guess, again, that light at the end of the tunnel. And that's been I placed my identity on my brain. I thought, well, I'm Gerard the hypnotist. That's what I'm known. I'm a hypnotist. I'm a mind reader. I can do all these extraordinary mental gymnastics. I put all my value and my stock in that identity. And when that was stripped from me, I didn't know who I was. And that was absolutely rock bottom for me, because I thought, I don't have a life anymore. That's all that I was. But in the same time now, I can retroactively look back and go, I feel stronger today knowing that I shouldn't have put so much stock in that identity, because I learned that my career wasn't my life. But my life is my career. And whatever you choose to do in your life, that's fine. But your career is not your life.
Do you know anyone who could relate?
I had one friend who's a vet. He did like 3 tours of overseas. And when he came back, can't get a job. He doesn't know who he is because he was just been a soldier for so long. That's who his identity was. So he doesn't know what he likes. So there's a lot to be learned by not placing so much value in our jobs and in our careers. Because one of the top 5 regrets of the dying, they say, is people wish they hadn't worked so hard. like not worked hard as an effort, like worked hard as in at their job 9 to 5 or doing just this job thinking this is it. If I only just work and work and work, everything, I'll have enough money and be safe. And that's not true because I did that and I got hit by a truck and my whole life got stripped away from me.
We put so much into work over a lifetime.
You never know what the future holds, but I live my life today feeling very comforted that if I was to be gone tomorrow, I would be not only happy to go, I've got a lot further than I ever thought that I would. And I feel totally blessed and totally lucky to have done the things I've done, the things I've seen, traveled. So I think that that's kind of a good mindset. Having that just enough peace to be peaceful, but not enough to be complacent. You've always got to have enough inspiration to get up in the morning and put pants on and leave your house and go do something, go find the next adventure.
Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to deal with the challenge of having a traumatic brain injury that no one can see? I can definitely relate to that. I've had one and it's a challenge, but what does that look like for you?
Well, you know, anybody that's had a concussion or had that feeling, it's interesting. My perception of it now and then is obviously different, but at the time I remember thinking that this was my little secret, because if people looked at me, my physical appearance, I have blonde tussled hair and I just look like a normal guy. It's this invisible thing that's in your head. If they could step in your head for a moment and see the tornado of anxiety and just overwhelming and everything's loud and bright and just trying to focus and listen and smile and nod and pretend everything's okay. It was overwhelming. It was like I would break into full body sweats and panic attacks consistently. Even today, if I'm driving, the radio comes on and my partner asks me a question, I'm like, okay, hold on. I'm like, turn the radio off. I learned now there's like warning signs or things that I can do to cope. But back then, anything was too much.
Is there a moment that still stands out before you learned how to cope?
The moment that I mentioned earlier, I was actually walking through Safeway and my partner at the time said, can you pick out a spaghetti sauce? I'll be at the end of the aisle, go get some spaghetti noodles. And I couldn't remember what kind of spaghetti sauce we like. And I remember seeing the aisle, the shelf grow like 10 feet tall and the aisle getting like 30 feet long. And I just collapsed with my arms over my face and started crying my eyes out. And people looked at me like I was crazy. Of course, my partner came down and we had to jump in a cab to go 2 blocks home because I was just completely obliterated. And I would see people on the street saying, oh, hey, Gerard, oh, hey, can you read my mind? And I was like, oh, I got to go. I'm really busy. And I don't even know. So my ears are ringing out of control. My head's pounding. But you look at me and you go, oh, like, I look totally fine. It's such a deficit in your life that when it subsides even a little bit, the gratitude that I had, the joy of being able just to plug in my parking meter number one day was incredible. That was a big win for me. That was a big day. So
has there been a positive impact from that? I mean, how has that manifested in you in a positive way?
It's made me very compassionate and very patient, thinking that maybe people that I see, not to judge them, because you don't know what they're going through. You don't know what's happening in people's lives. So I think that the world right now could really do from being more compassionate and patient and kind. The whole online world kind of desensitizes people to all of those things as well. So it's kind of getting it from both ends. People are getting naturally desensitized by their own life. And then online, I think I saw a thing with Louis C.K., the comedian, a long time ago. He said, kids will text the worst things to each other. But for a kid to go and say that to another kid's face and watch them cry, that's a very hard thing to do. So it's just like people are kind of modifying their behavior and how wicked they can be behind a keyboard or, you know, texting or on social media or stuff. So I'm a big advocate of communicating in person and seeing people and listening when people talk. And I think that it's made me grow quite a bit. So
was photography the gateway for a new opportunity for you to start over?
Photography was introduced to me in 2012. I was sitting on the couch after months of being very out of it. I remember specifically watching a YouTube video, and it was based, I think I was searching something for inspiration or finding a new side of yourself or something like that. And I saw a photographer, a guy named Trey Radcliffe, and he has an amazing YouTube channel. He does these HDR photos, and he was my age. And he was actually born in July, a couple of days before me, I believe. He was a guy from Texas, I think, originally, and super nice guy, and born blind in one eye. And he started photography when he was like 39. And within 1 year, he had one of his HDR photos put in the Smithsonian. He's the only photographer to have an HDR photo in the Smithsonian. And he said he quit his job as a computer programmer. He started doing travel photography and landscape photography full-time. He said he rediscovered this incredible creative side of himself that he never knew he had. And he completely started his life over again, which is very, very strange. And he said he looked into the camera and they were doing a spot on him. And he said, so if there's someone sitting there on their couch right now that is, for whatever reason, life has plucked you out and you're a creative person, maybe you have a background in something creative, maybe you have some aesthetic, there's something about you that draws photography, just pick up a camera and try. And you may find that you could have a new path, a journey, an adventure to go down. And I, for that moment, maybe it was the brain injury, but I was 100% positive that he was talking to me. So I researched cameras and I found a little Sony RX100, who at that time had made Time's top 50 best inventions of all time. And it was a small little camera, and I found one on eBay, and I hobbled across the street from my beachfront apartment, and I tried to take a picture of the beach, and it looked like shit. The sky was all blown out and there was blurry and I didn't know how to use the camera. And on the back of the camera, there's a little button that has a question mark on it. And I go, what the hell is this? So I pressed it and it said, trying to take landscape photos, try this setting and do this. They gave you little tips and it would come up in anything you're trying to shoot. So the camera would advise me, became my little guru. And so I started running back and forth from the beach to my house, which got me out of the house hobbling around. It was only 2 blocks. And I started teaching myself how to take pictures. And this got me out of the house exercising. Eventually that 2 blocks grew to half a mile, then around the seawall. Then I was going on full days. I got a little tripod. And 6 months later, I ended up traveling to my good friend who I mentioned earlier, Bro's house, Bro Gilbert. And he has a beachfront house with this old dinghy. He has this little wooden boat. And I set up my camera and I took an HDR long exposure photo of this little boat. And it was wonderful. It was really beautiful. I almost cried looking at this going, I did this. Can't believe I created this.
That's a pretty significant moment in rediscovering your creativity.
The story gets important because I went back and at that time, Google Plus was around. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll put this photo out on Facebook. So I put this photo on Facebook and people were liking it like crazy. And this is amazing. Who took this photo? What is this photo? Oh my God. It was called the Floozy because that's the name of the little wooden dinghy. I put it on there. Then I panicked and I deleted it because people were asking. And I said, gee, should I tell them? Should it be me? And so then I put it back up and said, this is my photo. And I started photography and I put it on Google Plus. And shortly after, maybe a couple of months, 3 months, I got a text. It says, this is Google Plus. We'd like to do an interview with you. A very famous photographer has seen your photo on Google and thought it was fantastic and wants to do an interview with like 4 or 5 other photographers that may be up and coming new photographers that he thinks have incredible potential. And I go, wow, that's amazing. And they go, the guy's name is Trey Radcliffe.
That's incredible.
And I go, that's the guy who I watched. And so he picked my photo with 5 other guys off the entire internet. And so here I was face to face telling this guy how he called me and he said, oh man, we watched Mind Freak and I didn't know it was you. So it was kind of weird. To this day, we're very good friends. And so it's amazing to see how the universe showed me this guy who was talking about starting your life over. And I just picked up a camera and did it. I thought, okay, if I can do this, I can do anything. So I started shooting people and places and animals, and cups of coffee. And then Sony called me and said, hey, we read your story. It's really cool. We'd like to invite you to Sony headquarters and give you a camera. I'm like, wow. So I went out to Sony headquarters, met the rep and started having a relationship with them. Then fast forward, now I have a studio downtown and I work doing everything from fashion, portrait photography, headshots and cinematography, and the whole thing. So it's just been incredible.
Your work is absolutely fantastic. I was looking at your photos even today of the smoke when you were walking around town. It's really incredible. And I wanted to ask, is cinematography you're directing now as well? Is that a natural gateway from photography?
Well, it is in the regard that cinematography and photography both share some things in common and there's some things that are completely different. The things they share in common are that, and to be honest, I talked with Trey and he said, he goes, you're a photographer bomb waiting to go off, because I'd had years working as a hairstylist. So I know a lot about aesthetic and balance of color and symmetry and geometry. And being myself on TV in front of a camera, I know a little bit about being on a set and how this works. So I kind of had this aesthetic from hairdressing, and I was an art director, and I just had all these things going on. So as soon as I realized that I could direct the talent in front of me, because I have already been that talent, I was on TV every day filming 12 hours a day, 6 days a week for months at a time. So I recognize people's potential, and it's brought out a side of me that's not as a talent, but as a director, it's also, you have to be a cheerleader. You have to find the best parts of somebody and bring those out, which is what I was doing in hairdressing. I'd look at someone's face, lifestyle, hair, and I give them the best cut for their life. Same thing with directing in some weird ways. You have to look at an actor, find his strengths, find a way to make them be in control, but yet vulnerable, and how the people relate to them. And then you have to light that, and then coloring and post-production. And so it was all similar to things that I'd already had in my life. It feels very comfortable. And just recently, this last year, I got into acting, which was a really crazy transition as well. So you can look on YouTube and see Andrew Girard Acting Reel 2020 and see some of the things that I've done so far. That's crazy now that I'm 49. I'm thinking, am I really going to start acting at 49? And the answer is yes.
Well, where can people find your work, your photography, your videos, everything?
So westlightfilm.com, westlightfilm.com is my website that I have. It has a whole wide array of short films that I've done, feature films. I direct a lot of music videos. I actually just worked with a wonderful 21-year-old country singer named Brooke Trainer. She's from Vancouver. I directed her first music video for her single called I Ain't No Fool, and it'll be out September 18th. It's amazing. I fully endorse this girl. I think she's going to be the next Canada's country sweetheart. She's just so talented. And that's really a big part of it too, is being able to work with younger people and help them out. And it's kind of the same way that Scott Lewis helped me out back in the day playing the Riviera. But other than that, I'm Andrew Girard Photography on Instagram and Facebook. I'm not on social media a whole lot. I just basically post my work and then run away. Sometimes I'll go on there and mingle, but I prefer real life.
I read one of your blog posts from a few years ago. It was a personal post, but you actually said, there's magic in starting over. Do you still believe that in the same way?
Every single day I wake up, I audition for my life. Every single day, I don't rest on any laurels. I start over almost daily in some way. I try and relax my body, and I go with the flow of the river, and I don't fight it. I meditate now more than ever. My fiance, who's a yoga teacher and an actress, is a wonderful influence on me for that. I find a lot of strength in your ability to sacrifice who you are for who you can become. It's the bravest thing we can do.
What advice do you have for people who are lost in a similar way where you were lost, starting over, and they can't see a better future? What advice do you have for people?
Well, I think you can visualize it like this. The feeling that you're lost is only because you think you're supposed to be somewhere else. Getting back to my little river analogy, this idea that you can't force the world to happen, you're always exactly where you're supposed to be. So take comfort in that. Even the moments when you feel lost, you're supposed to feel lost in that moment. And I know that that's really hard for some people to swallow, because it's really hard to say, well, people are supposed to go through horrible things. But without horrible things, how would you have really great things? You can't have light unless you've been in a complete black room and not seen light. Otherwise, how do you know it's there? So I think for people is take comfort in the fact that you're always where you're exactly where you're supposed to be. And when it comes to starting over and finding your way, just know that it's your way that you're trying to find, not someone else's way. Nobody can tell you what you're supposed to do. You can't look for the answer to anything outside of yourself. There's no things that can fix you that aren't inside you. Every answer to every question you have is already inside of you. You really just have to be still and listen and really connect with yourself, because there's a part of yourself in your mind that's listening and watching, even when you're sleeping, all the time. And it's a part of ourselves that we don't connect with enough, I believe. And I think if you're still and listen, you'll start to find that inner voice inside of you, of who you are and who you've always been, will start to speak a little louder. And when you start to listen to it and follow it, it's very freeing, because I live my life as much of the truth as I can. And I catch myself daily. So I'm not perfect, but I'll tell you, you can't think one thing in your head and then act a different way out in the world. You have to align your inner mind with your outer actions, because not only does it affect you and your success or failure in life, it's going to affect people around you with your actions, your words, even your thoughts. So if everyone starts by accepting and not fighting where they're at and say, okay, at least I know where my starting point is. In my case, I couldn't get any lower. I hit rock bottom. I was like, well, I know exactly where my starting point is here. I'm at zero. So there's some real strength in hitting rock bottom. There's security in that because, to be honest, Reg, if I had to go back there, I could do it no problem. I could go right back to ground zero and start over again if I had to because I've already been there. So sometimes it's good to be a little uncomfortable. I gave this advice yesterday to my friend. She got laid off at her job and she's like, 25, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I go, good, then rejoice in that, that you don't know what you have this because this feeling is going to go away and you're going to be back at another job soon. But take this time out to really look inside yourself and find out what you want to do. And we talked about it. It turns out she's an amazing poet. So I made a call with a friend of mine at a publishing company and she's going to publish a poetry book and move forward. And this could be the beginning of a whole new adventure for her. Who knows?
It's fantastic. Thank you very much for being so open, being so vulnerable with this. Your story is important. And when I heard it, I really relate to it. The reason why I started this show was I kind of get a sense the way the world's heading that more and more people are going to have to start over, whether it's through automation, this pandemic. And what I'm finding is that a lot of people don't know how to start over, don't know how to deal with change. So this story that you're sharing, your experience, is super important.
Well, I'm glad. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Starting Over Drive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Podbean, head to the Starting Over Drive Facebook page and hit the like button, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over. Or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find the Starting Over Drive podcast at www.startingoverdrive.com.